That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year. Dawson City, Nevada, March 17. This capital city of the Silver State on this St. Patrick's Day has become the mecca of prize fight fans the world over. For on this day, James John Corbett, 31 years old, is defending his crown as heavyweight champion of the world against British-born Robert Prometheus Fitzsimmons, 4 years his senior, already the holder of the middle heavyweight and the light heavyweight championships. The grueling grind goes on and on through 5, 10, 11, 12, 13 rounds. Finally, in the 14th round, another battle of the century is over. Gentleman Jim, the man who took the crown from the great John L. Sullivan, the man who added the phrase solar plexus to a picturesque pugilistic vocabulary, fell before the onslaught of a new world's heavyweight champion, Bob Fitzsimmons.
1897, that was the year.
Virgo Harbor, Danes Island, Spitsbergen, July 11. A group of heavily clothed, serious-faced men stand round a crudely built structure, inside of which could be seen a 67-foot balloon.
Well, shall we try it?
I guess we're as ready now as we ever shall be.
What do you say, Niels?
Yes, I think we should go now.
Gentlemen, we have been thinking it over, whether to start our journey or not. My comrades insist that we begin, and inasmuch as I have absolutely no reason not to, I agree to start. Although I will admit I am somewhat reluctant to do so. Set all hands at dismantling the balloon house.
Thus did the historic little expedition under the heroic leadership of Noah's Salomon August André, and comprising also his two countrymen Nils Strindberg and Knut Frankel, rise from the earth in their balloon, rechristened for the event Urnen, the Eagle, and head northward over the open sea toward their destination, the North Pole. 4 days later, the skipper of the Norwegian seal ship Alken shoots what he believes to be a ptarmigan, discovers it to be a carrier pigeon, bearing on its spindly leg a tube.
Well, look at this. This is a message from André.
Then nothing. No word. No indication of success or failure. Until
May 14, 1899.
On the north coast of Iceland, a buoy, battered by almost 2 years buffeting in Arctic waters, floats to the shore, reveals another cryptic message from the André expedition. Then nothing until
September 11, 1899.
2 years and 2 months after it had been thrown from the balloon, another buoy is discovered on the rocky coast of King Charles Land, pushed 60 paces up the beach by winter ice. Then nothing until
August 27, 1900.
On the coast of Finnmark, Norway, a woman gathering driftwood picks up another André buoy, bearing another message, the first to be cast from the balloon more than 3 years before. But the last word the world is to receive from the expedition until
August 6, 1930.
Two young members of a Norwegian scientific expedition, anchored off desolate, glacier-encrusted White Island in the Sela Bratvag, are on shore, resting after an exciting walrus hunt.
Carl, let's find some fresh water from the glacier there. I'm thirsty.
So am I, Olaf. Come on.
Carl!
Yeah, what is it?
Look here. An aluminum cover from a cooking pot of some kind.
How can that be? No one has ever been on this island before us. It is not even charted.
Oh. Look, Carl. A boat, half covered by ice.
Yeah, I see it. Look! Olaf! Olaf! Beyond the boat, the body of a man!
33 years and 26 days after Andrei Frankel and Strindberg had set out to discover the North Pole in their balloon, a party of their countrymen under the leadership of Dr. Gunnar Horn discovered the last resting place of the three tragic figures. In their decaying boat was found almost all of their equipment, together with the daily log of their harrowing journey, rolls of undeveloped film, letters in shorthand to Niels Strindberg's fiancée, all amazingly well preserved. The Arctic had surrendered its grim solution to the tragic mystery of the Andrei party.
1897, that was the year.
While British forces were battling the furious Fulahs in Nigeria, while Parliament was investigating the enigma of the Jameson raid in South Africa, while famine and plague gnawed at the vitals of British-controlled Mother India, while a South African millionaire was confessing his contribution of £50,000 to the insurrection in the Transvaal, on June 22, throughout the British Empire, they began the celebration of the Diamond Jubilee, solemnizing the longest reign in the history of England. 78-year-old Victoria Regina had worn the crown for 60 years.
...1897, that was the year.
Seattle, Washington, July 17. Down Old Front Street, down Yesler Way, past Pioneer Square and the Totem Pole, down toward the waterfront stream hundreds of citizens of this little-known lumber and shipping town to welcome the steamship Portland, just docking after a journey through the inland passage from Alaska.
Do you see him yet, Tommy?
Not yet, Mama. Oh, yeah, there he is. There's Daddy. Hello, Daddy.
Hello, Dave. Hello.
Hello, Em. Be right with you.
Oh, doesn't he look well, though? And he's so happy.
I guess he's glad to get home. Huh, Mama?
I guess so, Tommy.
Oh, Em.
Oh,
Em.
Dave.
Let me get a kiss from Daddy, too. Huh, Mama?
You bet.
Darling.
Ah, there you are, son. Oh, Em. Em, we're rich.
Rich? Wait, what do you mean?
Em, in these valises here, I've got $50,000.
$50,000?
In gold, Em. Gold, dust, and gold nuggets. I could have brought out more, but I staked out three more claims. In the Klondike, darling. Way up the Yukon River in the Northwest Territory of Canada on Bonanza Creek. You and Tommy and I are selling everything here in Seattle, taking the Portland right back to Alaska. We're rich, darling! Rich!
Gold. The spark that inflamed thousands the world's over into frenzied action. Gold, the open sesame which would unlock the gates to wealth, untold wealth. Gold, the magic key which would open the door to security and happiness. The fabulous tale soon spread throughout the nation and across the oceans. The story of how in the late summer of the preceding year, two white men, Bob Henderson and George Carmack, and two Indians, Skookum Jim and Tagish Charlie, had made the discovery of the richest gold strike in the memory of man. How the news had been carried 300 miles to Circle City. How Bert Hudson on claim number 6 had picked up a nugget valued at $257. How J.J. Clemens of Los Angeles had taken out $175,000, his last four pans worth $2,000, and how T.C. Lippy of Seattle had brought out $50,000 and had $150,000 more in sight. On and on went the stories. Higher and higher were builded the hopes of millions. Almost overnight, Seattle doubled its population, became the port of departure for the Yukon goldfields. But in September, a note of alarm was heard.
Don't come up this year. The mud on the trail is awful, sometimes 3 and 4 feet deep. Horses and mules get mired down and have to be shot.
Suffering here in Dawson City is terrible. Over 1,000 people without anything to eat. One man, not a common thief, but driven to steal by hunger, has been shot. Don't try it this winter.
A horrible disease has broken out here. 24 hours after a person is afflicted, he turns black and 2 days later is dead. Stay away from this place this year. There's plenty of gold here, but wait till spring.
In the year 1897 in the Klondike, which had started so hysterically with a newfound gold, ended in despair. Famine, disease, failure, death.
1897, that was the year.
New York City, October 18.
As trucks pull away from 170 Nassau Street to distribute this day's edition of the New York Sun, the faces of the drivers are unusually grim, somber. For while other metropolitan newspapers carry column upon column about the event, the Sun carries upon page one the laconic item,
Charles Anderson Dana, editor of the Sun, died yesterday afternoon.
Charles Anderson Dana, for 30 years the guiding genius of the New York Sun, last of the picturesque proponents of a personal journalism, died in his 78th year. The intense popularity of his newspaper had been built upon the terse slogan,
"Be interesting."
1897, that was the year
that Paul Dresser, brother of the noted American novelist Theodore Dreiser, first copyrighted this touching ballad of the 90s.
While strolling down the street one evening, upon mere pleasure bent, 'twas after business worries of the day, I saw a girl who shrank from me, in whom I recognized my schoolmate in a village far away. "Is that you, Madge?" I said to her. She quickly turned away. "Don't turn away, Madge. I am still your friend. Next week I'm going back to see the old folks, and I thought perhaps some message you would like to send."
"Just tell them that you saw me," she said, "then all the rest. Just tell them I was looking well, you know. Just whisper if you get a chance to Mother dear and say, I love her as I did long, long ago."
"Your cheeks are pale, your face is thin. Come tell me, were you ill? When last we met, your eyes shone clear and bright. Come home with me when I go, Madge. The change will do you good. Your mother wonders where you are tonight. I long to see them all again, but not just yet," she said. "'Tis pride alone that keeps me in the way. Just tell them not to worry, for I'm all right, don't you know? Tell Mother I am coming home someday."
"Just tell them that you saw me," she said, "they'll know the rest. Just tell them I was looking well, you know. Just whisper if you get a chance to Mother dear and say, I love her as I did long, long ago."
Thank you.